Tonight on Arena, one man and his truck. Michael Murphy takes to the road with his new play Middletown, and new albums from Ragger as Stephen Fretwell and the Goonsacks up for review. @51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Actor, director, writer Michael Murphy is taking to the road next week in a truck and a play commissioned by Dublin's Gate Theatre. Middletown is the tale of a furniture removals man who one day packs up his own belongings and sets off on the adventure of a lifetime. Anyone lucky enough to have seen Michael's one-man shows like The Man in the Woman's Shoes or I Hear You and Rejoice will recall his extraordinary creation of the role of the mute cobbler Patsy Farnan. In both productions, he brought an entire village to life in a tour de force physical performance that showcased his gifts as an actor and his early training at the Jacques Lecoq School in Paris. Middletown, very different prospect, I would have thought, but Michael will tell us whether he thinks it's a different prospect or not. Good to have you with us this evening, Michael. Great to see you.
Yeah, you too.
When I heard this idea, it was the Gate Theatre who came to you, Selena Cartmell, who came to you and said, look, we want to have a show in a truck that we can travel around the place.
Yeah.
Will you write something?
Yeah. Something that would be COVID friendly, obviously, you know, get it out. It's an outdoor show, so we can have 100-150 people outdoors, socially distanced and all that. And it was kind of a lovely departure for them. They wanted to be in production. Because, you know, COVID has closed the gate down for so long. And Selena and the folk in there had this idea. I really, you know, she rang me and I said, that's the exact sort of thing that I'd be up to. Do you know what I mean? Put me on the back of a truck and sail me around the country. Yeah. And I love going around the country with the other two shows you mentioned.
Yeah.
We've been everywhere. And now we can be even more everywhere because, you know, the truck can park anywhere effectively. Do you know what I mean? You need a bit of a car park and you're in. Do you know what I mean? Yeah, but we're going to visit some beautiful places like Emo Court and Portlaoise. And, you know, there's all sorts of gorgeous venues coming our way.
That can open up to you. And it's in Middletown is actually the
title.
In Middletown, not just
Middletown. Yeah. In Middletown.
But what you were telling me just before we came to air, because I thought when I took a look at the script or whatever, an early version of the script, and I thought, oh, what a great idea. It's in a truck, so let's have something to do with a truck. This is a furniture removals man. Yeah. Tell us how that came about.
Well, only very, by happenstance really, because I figured you have a truck, what you put on a truck in terms of a set, et cetera, et cetera. What kind of a show will you make for that truck? And I was talking to a friend of mine who was in school with me in Paris many years ago, Antonio Gil Martinez, a fellow in Spain, and I was telling him about this truck. And he said, of course, he's a furniture removals man. And the minute he said it, I went, sure, of course he is. And then this story evolved around this man who, you know, drives out of his driveway one day and he hits the roundabout and he turns back on himself and he just goes home quietly and he just puts what he needs from his house into the back of his truck, sets it up, and it's a living environment. So he goes on the road.
He goes on the road, and while this isn't necessarily, it's not a lockdown piece per se, but it does look at some of the things maybe that many people discovered in lockdown, this idea of slowing down, of savouring what's around you rather than being on the move all the time.
Oh yeah, for sure. And I think I was writing it from, you know, I like plays when they're, you know, written with purpose so that the person who's writing the play knows what the play is for to them. Not necessarily the audience doesn't necessarily need to know the personal journey that you're on, but actually it means something more to you and you write better. I think you'll put a veneer of fiction over the top of it, but there are things in it that mean a lot to me in terms of just where I am in my life at the moment. So I wanted to write a show that just reflected on that, I suppose. And it's something that didn't necessarily come out of COVID. It's something that's been around for a while because even though I don't look it, Sean, I am 54. And at that age, you know, you're starting to go, okay, well, this is an interesting time of your life. Do you know what I mean? There's a few to go. There's a few behind you. You know, there's more behind me now than there's ahead of me. You know what I mean? So what do you want to do? And also, like, the pace of us, the energy of us at the moment in the world is something that is, like, quite radical and it's very, very, very full on. Do you know what I mean? And I just began to reflect on solitude. I read loads of really beautiful books. A lovely book called How to Be Alone, where the woman suggests that most people who look at a person who wants this kind of solitude in their life assume that the person is either sad, mad or bad. And I figured, I like solitude very often. I, you know, I have a beautiful life. I have a great, you know, partnership. I have a great, you know, set of family and friends. But I really value my solitude at the moment. And I liked this idea of creating a work around a man who was neither sad, mad or bad, but just needed to take more time to himself, more peace.
Because the always the presumption is, oh, actor, outgoing, wants to be in the crowd all the time, needs to be up there, needs to be soaking up attention, needs loads of people to feed his or her ego.
Yeah. Yeah,
not necessarily the case.
Not at all. No, I'm well able to talk, but I, Christine Monk, the lovely publicist who got me in here, I'm a friend of yours for years. So I like coming here because I know you know the work and I know you know how the work operates. But I do as little as I can by way of publicity because I'm very private. In actual fact, you know, I'm very gregarious, but I'm actually quite private about my private life as well. So. You know, there's things like that that you're reflecting on, and actors aren't, you know, always like, you know, one of my favourite actresses, I can't say her name, but she's intensely shy, intensely private. She's one of the best actresses I've ever worked with, but she has a privacy and she's entitled to that privacy, you know what I mean? And I like living in a world where, particularly when you work in theatre, the demographic that sees theatre in Ireland, you know, doesn't recognise you. You don't. I'm not on telly and film because of the size of my head. And, you know, it's interesting to me that I can work in a very public way with the other shows, but I don't have to be public necessarily. I like meeting people afterwards. It's great crack. But other than that, I'd like to keep myself to myself.
So that idea of putting on the mask of another character or several characters, as it was in some of the shows, you know, but that idea of doing that, is that actually a great way of, I don't know if protecting is the right word, but of kind of keeping yourself for yourself, not giving it all away.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think people who discover that in acting very often find that that's a very useful thing for them to have, is this, you know. But if you get very practiced at putting on that mask, then you sometimes lose, you know, a sense of who you are yourself. Do you know what I mean? If you're constantly, if my job is to play, you know, in my own plays, 15 people in each play, you know, you start getting, you know, into the territories of, you know, how many people do I have in my head at any one time? Do you know what I mean?
And I suppose that's what's interesting about this fella then, that in some ways he's doing that journey back into himself kind of, who am I and what do I want?
And actually, what I hope will be interesting to people about this show is that he wants very, very little. And he doesn't actually pursue an awful lot. So it's not as if he's going out to find himself. He just needs a bit of space. So effectively, he says about it that he's crossing a transitional threshold. He doesn't know if he's going anywhere. He doesn't know if there's anything in the future, and he doesn't desire anything or want anything from a future, but he's prepared to step away from something that's behind him just to see what might happen.
That was one of the things in the script that jumped out at me, was this line about if he's moving, what would he need? And it's need. What would he really need to bring with him in the back of this truck?
Yeah, we need nothing. Really, do you know what I mean? Like if we sit down, like we're voracious as a society, Western society, like you think you need something, but you know, what you actually do is you want. So you want to have the telly, you want to have this and you want to have that. But whether or not you need those things is, you know, debatable or up for grabs. And I he's a very soft kind of a guy. Like he wouldn't even, you know, he wouldn't have the sort of the philosophical capacity or the social capacity to discuss with a group of people around a dinner table, what do we need, what do we not need? He just needs, he knows, he has a fundamental sense that he needs very little.
Yeah.
So he heads off.
Does he need bees and does he need honey?
He needs honey because he loves honey.
I think that might be, and this, you know, you're saying I know you for years. I do know you for years, but there'll be lots of private things about you that I would know nothing about, despite the fact that I know you for years.
Sean, there's things my mother doesn't even know about me.
But the bees and the honey, the honey certainly is something that is true of Michael Murphy this character.
I love honey. So I'll get into the bees at some stage. But yeah, actually, funnily enough, I've developed a kind of a quiet affinity with the idea of bees. There's a beautiful piece, you'll find it on the RTE archive. I can't tell you exactly where it was, but some of the Saturday morning programmes, someone went to visit a man. He's over in Uachtaráid or somewhere like that, and he keeps bees, but he has a little hut that he has built over the beehives. So he can go into this hut and lie down with the low hum of the bees underneath him. And the image of that struck me very forcibly. So this is, you know, my love for honey. And bees are referenced in the other two shows a lot as well, actually. The man, everybody in Ireland, people tell the bees everything. It's quite a tradition. People who keep bees, they'll, if something is important about to happen in the family, they'll go and tell the bees.
And is that a kind of an offloading thing, do you think, or what do you think that is?
I suspect it's to do with the fact that, you know, it's an incredibly complex, you know, society, a bee hive, if you like. And there's always been this kind of tradition in Ireland and in other cultures as well, Native American Indian cultures, etc., where, you know, bees are important, and it, unless they're told, things can go wrong.
Yeah. So it's not just a simple, let me get this off me chest type of thing. There's more to it than that.
Yeah,
you need the bees on your side.
Yeah.
You need nature on your side.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I'm just back from Anna McCarrigan working up there on another show with a woman called Annika Zuba, who was in Swan Lake with me a couple of years back, the Michael Keegan Dolan show. We were out for a walk one day, and like it strikes you very forcibly, especially in the times that we're in at the moment. Like, I mean, people got out and walked and went and walked and walked and walked during COVID because they had never walked before, half of them. Do you know what I mean? But the intensity of that natural thing that we're in is quite affecting and quite radical. So this man, you know, drives away in his truck. He slides back the curtain side of the truck, and he has a 27-foot wide window straight onto nature.
Yeah.
And it's incredibly soothing for him. I think that's what I'm looking to do. Although, like, I mean, it was hilarious. I was in rehearsals, you know, showing some of the gang the show in rehearsals. And I thought I had written a quite uplifting, you know, show about solitude and embracing solitude and these things about itself. And they're all looking at it going, Michael, it's awful sad. So I don't want to give too much away. But, like, it's actually I hope it's sweet.
Yeah.
But there's something odd about it. It seems to be doing something.
Serene was what I got from the script.
Yeah.
I don't know what I'll get from the performance itself, but that was more what I saw than serenity rather than sadness.
I hope so. Serenity would be... I'd love serenity. If you gave me serenity, I'd take your hand off for serenity.
Yeah. However, given all of that, you know, when you read a play script, you read stage directions as well as everything else, and what you see on the stage, then the stage directions become as much as important as any words that are spoken.
Yeah,
there's no shortage of physicality in this piece,
no.
as usual.
Yeah, no, there's quite a lot. Although he's quite a you know, sedentary character. He's not hugely, you know, he's not a jumper and a leper. He's not fast. Mm. But and I actually found it's very interesting. Like, I like, you know, stillness. I worked with Enda Walsh a lot, and Enda and I were always killed trying to figure out how, in theatrical terms, can you create the equivalent of what is, you know, a very, very prevalent thing in our society now, the close-up. So in TV and in film, you can cut to the close-up of the weepy eye, but you can't see somebody's eyes after five rows in a theatre.
Yeah.
So stillness was what we figured. So, you know, with something like Ballyturk, where myself and Killian were in motion, you know, or Tadhg Murphy were in motion almost constantly. When you needed focus, if either of us stood still, that was the effect of the close-up. You know, the audience zoomed in because suddenly there was immobility.
So this is what you're using in this? That
it was. It was a huge thing with Lecoq. Yeah. Lecoq would always say you can't have words unless you have something more important to say than the silence, and you can't have movement unless you have something better to do than stillness.
Well, you look at any play with text in it, and often before the big pause, the big dramatic pause, you'll have a big long line so that you earn the pause.
Yeah, exactly,
you know?
Exactly.
So it's a similar type of thing.
And also, you know, some of our, you know, best playwrights, Beckett and, you know, Tom Murphy, they were incredibly specific about the musicality of the language, and they would specify and say down in rehearsals, Tom was brilliant at it, about specifying to actors where the pauses happened, because he could hear the musicality of it and he knew where he could direct the audience's attention.
And I'll just say, in terms of the stillness, the other part of this play that's important is there's you as the man speaking to us at times in the audience.
Yeah.
There's a voiceover who's kind of narrating us through the piece, but there's also a voiceover which is the inner thoughts of the man. So that allows you on stage to be stock still.
Yeah. Yeah, very often, like the on-stage character, the live talking from me, which is unusual for me because I talk the hind legs of a donkey, but I'm delighted with myself because there's virtually no lines in this one. But the voiceover, there are two types of voiceover, and I'm hoping that, you know, the audience will realise that there's that combination of voices, that they're all one and the same.
All right. Well, listen, I need to save a bit more of my hind legs for later on, so I can't let you keep talking them off.
Good man. Oh, Jesus.
Great to speak with you,
Michael. Yeah, and you too, Sean.
I'm really looking forward to seeing the show, and people will get a chance to see it in various venues. In Middletown is the name of the show. Runs from the 22nd of July through until the 12th of August, touring to Dunleer, Galway, Ennis, Limerick, Portlaoise, Longford and Letterkenny. And you'll find out full information on gate-theatre.ie. The Time Being is the first poetry collection from John Fitzgerald. The poems explore place and memory, family, relationships and the natural world. Moments from America, Iceland and China are set among the experiences of the land and countryside around the poet's home in rural Ireland. Delighted to have John Fitzgerald join us from our Cork studio. And just because of what we've just been speaking with Michael Murphy, John, I'd like to start with the title poem from the collection, because I think it speaks to those moments of stillness that Michael was talking about in terms of a theatre show. Let's hear that opening poem, or that title poem rather, The Time Being, and we can talk about it afterwards.
Sure, Sean. Thank you, and it's great to be here. Let me just get that for you. I really enjoyed listening to Michael, and it did resonate. This is The Time Being, and it's the title poem of the collection. Now, just before noon, still morning a few minutes more, the mist lifts and the sun comes out, and the fields beyond the wood are visible, bright between the trees, making her sit up from her bolster among breakfast things, books, newspapers, notelets, a photograph, throw back the counterpane, stand and stretch and walk to the bay to swing wide the windows, her arms open to the warmth of the sun returning, and watch as the last straw bales are gathered from the paddocks so that the full extent of the flattest land can be cleared and free for her to catch and groom and tack her sable mare to ride all day through fresh stubble, still harbouring plentiful grain for the grey birds flocking too, as she, on her mount, striding now, holds high her head in the last warm rays pouring like silken gold over hair and arms and face.
John Fitzgerald with The Time Being, the title poem from his new collection. And there was just something about the opening section of that poem in particular, John, that resonated for me with what Michael Murphy had been talking about, moments of stillness. And I think in many ways that is what poetry has provided for you, if I'm not putting words in your mouth. You work in UCC, you also look after the family farm. Where does poetry fit in to what is clearly a very busy life?
Everywhere. It fits in everywhere. And it fits in, I suppose, because I am constantly talking to myself. I'm constantly turning words around, a bit like Malloy's pebble stones. I'm turning them around. I'm kind of hypersensitive, really, to my landscape, to my surroundings, particularly the natural world. I find it just endlessly fascinating. And, you know, I have the privilege of living in the countryside, you know, having a wonderful family, and many of the poems are inspired by the children, and also I've had some opportunity to travel. So I've never, somebody asked me recently, you know, where do you find the time to write? I've never found it a problem to find time to write.
Do you have a sense in both the writing, and I know you're a reader of poetry as well, John, do you have a sense that that is somehow stepping out from the busy lifestyle and it gives you a moment of repose, a moment of stillness, a moment of, you know, assessment, if you like?
It does, but I feel that it's actually part of it rather than separate to it. I think it was E.M. Forster said, "I don't know what I think until I hear myself say it." So, I think that living in the world, living in a busy world, part of that is listening to yourself, and moving words and moving themes around in your head.
Yeah, and I suppose this would feed directly into the poem that you have, is post-Socratic Disorder, which is actually, tell us where that is placed. It's part of a poetry in the park idea that's in and around your local area.
Yeah, well, it's physically in Ballincollig in one of the parks there, and it was erected by Cork City Council as part of a scheme that they had to put the poems on posters and place them in places where people were frequenting, particularly during COVID. And they invited me to put this one on and put this one up. And it's the poem itself is set at home. Our son Nicholas kept hens, and I loved having the hens around. I loved their activity and their, you know, sometimes they would be very, very calm and zen-like, at other times, you know, absolutely frantic. And I also loved their music. that they give. And this one came out of that, I suppose, relationship with them.
And I suppose, like Poetry on the Dart, it gives poetry a chance to be part of people's everyday movement and, as you say, part of their lives rather than stepping outside to kind of make poetry some kind of separate thing. I mentioned in my introduction that there are moments from America, Iceland and China. You mentioned that you've been lucky enough to travel around. I'm presuming that one WTC refers to his time spent in America.
That's right, in New York in particular. And you know, one WTC is the One World Trade Center, actually, and it's this enormous building built in the place of the Trade Center, you know, after the 9/11 attack. They refer to it in New York as the Freedom Tower. It's almost 2,000 feet tall. And I was walking along early one morning, winter's morning. I was walking along street in New York in the Tribeca district, and I came across this, I suppose, what we in our times a primary school, full of young kids milling around, you know, all in a world of their own. But behind them then came into my view with a kind of a shock. It's an enormous glazed structure. You know, I felt that, you know, the scale of this is something that these kids might actually find difficult to deal with in their lives. And the poem came out of that.
Well, let's hear the poem then, One WTC.
One WTC. A schoolyard in Tribeca, mid-morning, mid-winter. Shrill cries swarming like gulls around a tall figure, assenting with a smile to take each rubber ball and punch it with the top of a piston fist high up into the air, up where the children's faces follow, their eyes rising beyond fist, beyond head, beyond steel school roof, to each ball at its dependable point of fall. And indifferent to the continued upward going of this glimmering glass backdrop to it all, this one thing that one day will become for them everything that is impossible and beyond reasonable reach, like the first unexpected sight of the rest of their lives.
And that's One WTC, another of the poems in John Fitzgerald's collection, The Time Being. I've mentioned about your other work, John, and the other parts of your life. Has poetry always been there? And you're coming to it relatively late in terms of a first publication. Why has that been the case, do you think?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, I suppose. It's always been there. I studied English at UCC as an undergraduate, and it was just at the tail end of that great era of people like John Montagu and Sean Lucy and Eamon O'Carrigan, and they really ignited a passionate love of poetry for me. They also gave me a sense, particularly John Montagu, of the importance of writing as a way of life. And I suppose, you know, I never quite closed the door to writing myself, because I kept on reading poetry, I suppose, into my middle years. And then around 2010, I think it was, you know, I'd reached a period where the kids were a bit older. You know, I'd finished a few very intensive projects at work, and there was this kind of clearing in my life. And I just started to write. And also this voice in my head that I spoke of earlier, these conversations, they reached a kind of a pitch where they needed expression, and you know, these short lines began to appear on the page. And that's where it all started. But you know, I suppose age has never come into it for me, because, you know, I'm certainly not worried or regretful that I started writing in my late 40s and I'm publishing my first full-length book now in my late 50s. You know, I've just focused on the poems tried to conduct myself, as it were, as a mature emerging writer, irrespective of my calendar age.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, age is only a number, isn't it?
Yeah.
Or as I saw in a mug recently, age isn't even a number.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm not sure I could have written much in my 20s or 30s, because I didn't have that much experience to write from. And the older I get, the richer the hoard of experience and memory is. So it's interesting.
Tell me a little bit about the origins of the poem First Cut.
Yeah, First Cut is the first poem in my pamphlet, which appeared in 2017, Southward Editions in Cork, published it as part of their new Irish writing series. So it's in ways, it's my debut poem. It's the first poem here in this collection as well, The Time Being. It's a very simple setting, which I'm sure many people have found themselves in, watching someone cutting timber with a chainsaw, something I have always found immensely pleasing and engrossing. And I suppose this poem is my take on it.
Well, let's have a listen to First Cut.
First Cut. Nothing more heroic for a boy than a working chainsaw. The smoky, up-throttling roar, spray of dust ejecting, strain and strength and fixed eye of the holder. The sweet whiff of danger in exchange for raw power. It was like cutting into pure fear to sunder it, then smaller bits, so that it could never grow in the same place again. And when he refilled the empty tank straight from the petrol can, you would stand, your ears resounding a distant growl, and watch that old riddle of capacity and bore play out, as if this was what you had waited all day for, the glup, glup, glup becoming poor.
John Fitzgerald and his poem First Cut. I mentioned about working in UCC, John. You work in the information services there and as a university librarian. I mentioned working on the farm at home and clearly a very busy parent as well. Is it three or four children you have? I can't remember, sorry.
Four children.
So very busy in all of that. Will you now add, or has poet always been a way you would describe yourself?
That's an interesting question. I've only admitted the possibility of using poet to describe myself since I opened the box of books that came from Gallery Press a few weeks ago and pulled out my own publication. So even though I've been lucky in winning some prizes and etc. And indeed having published individual poems quite widely, it's really not until I've put these poems in between these particular covers of The Time Being that I've kind of feel, yeah, okay, now I can say poet.
All right, John Fitzgerald, father, husband, poet, librarian and farmer. Thanks for being with us this evening.
Thank you, Sean.
That's John Fitzgerald, and John's first collection, The Time Being, is published by Gallery Press. And so for our album reviews on this Friday evening, first up will be Ragora, the name of a collaborative project between multi-award-winning rapper and singer Murley, best known as a member of the Choice Music Prize-winning Russell Gano family and founder of Narrow Lane Records. He has teamed up with the Dublin-born electronic producer Kobina for this project. The album they have produced is called New Vessels. Next up, huge critical favourite, a man championed by the likes of Elbow and Oasis, Stephen Fretwell, maybe didn't achieve the stellar commercial successes of those champions. After a long hiatus, he's back with a new album that has once again set some critical hearts aflutter. The new album is called Busy Guy. And finally, the Goonsacks, indie pop trio from Brisbane in Australia. They've been working of late with PJ Harvey, collaborator and producer John Parrish. And their third album is out today. It's called Mirror 2. Kate Brennan Harding and Brian Boyd have been listening. We'll start at home here in Ireland, Ragora. New album is called New Vessels, and here's a track called Pressure.
Every now and then you see me behave like a man, chivalrous and attentive to each emotion you mutter. In return you will wax lyrical on my manners and how I was bred like man. Though the scar on my heart from early daily reminds me to trust no other. Even now my pain is struggling to keep track of the vision, hence why the most cynical man of the year award is in order. Took about split decision.
Pressure, the title of the track from New Vessels, and a collaboration called Ragora. Kate Brennan Harding, as I said, and Brian Boyd are two reviewers on this Friday evening. Kate, first of all, who are we talking about when we talk about Ragora?
Well, we're talking about, I think, Murley is one of the most prolific prolific songwriters, wordsmiths in Ireland right now. His record company with Denise Chyla and God knows Narrow Lane, like they are the definition of like what's really hot happening in the Limerick scene.
Yeah,
he's amazing, and he's already won the Choice Music Prize with Russell Gannon family. That is now in the past, and they're concentrating on lots of different kind of projects. And Kobina is an absolutely stunning producer, and what he has a knack of doing, I think, is creating really delicate sounds through electronic music and building them up. He's really, for me, he creates atmosphere. So the two of them combined, and they've created this album during lockdown. And actually, Kobina lives in Amsterdam, so they've created this over the ether. And it's, I think, it shows a remarkable kind of collaboration coming together.
You can get, believe, Brian, you have the meaning of the word, or certainly the origins of the word Ragora.
It's an old Irish term that means nighttime wanderer, and pretty appropriate for this album because you get that feeling of going on a journey with them. And from the very beginning, what I was impressed with here, you get this musical template, which is Merle's really emotive and expressive vocals, and these contrast brilliantly with Cobina's beats, which are more shoegaze to krautrock, or rather can be. So you're getting that beautiful contrast there, and also with the vocals, with Merle, you're going from you're almost getting like sweet pop R&B sometimes, and then other times you're getting this rage and fury, but it always matches up with the beats. And I was surprised to learn that the two of them haven't actually met in real life.
Yeah, that is extraordinary.
It's been done through Limerick and Amsterdam.
Yeah, and there's obviously something in the water in Limerick when it comes to hip-hop and rap in mm-hmm. particular. But Brian, using the words emotive and expressive there, Kate, and I think you talked about that as well in terms of the quality of the music here. What struck me was, despite the fact that we have titles like Terrified, Indecisive, Pressure, the track that we just heard, there is a kind of a... there isn't any aggression in the words that were being given here. It certainly didn't feel like that to me.
Yeah, no, I don't find aggression. I find a way of expressing feelings and emotions, and maybe opening up a dialogue in a new way. I think what for me, like particularly that song Pressure, it actually, the sonicscape of it is what it feels like in my head when I'm under a lot of pressure. And I think that Merle Dens, his lyrics are so, they can apply to anybody, you know, and it's definitely a way of releasing out those feelings without the negative emotion. And they said about New Vessels was that they both were trying to figure out new ways of coming into being, new ways of expressing themselves, creating themselves in a new way.
And you also said, Brian, I know that Pressure was one of your picks of songs from the album. Indecisive also was as well. What stands out about Indecisive? Because I'm going to play it now, Brian.
Very brooding, very menacing. I just love the way the beats work. Touches of, I was reminded quite a few times on Indecisive and other songs of bits of Massive Attack's Blue Lines, which was like the seminal album of the early 90s. That's how good it is. I thought Indecisive, I think it's the current single as well.
Yeah, it is indeed. Let's...
This life is so enticing. Your love is so demanding. To share it just the icing. This treasure I've been mining, the flashing light's blinding. It clips by the grinding. I know it's tiring. I'm absenting your diary.
Indecisive, the title of that track from Ragara and the debut album New Vessels. To you first, Brian, for stars and an overall judgment. I think you enjoyed this album.
Very much, and the singles are great. The song Feels, I thought, was one of the best songs I've heard all year. I think there was a song Out Loud just let me completely cold, and that sort of confused me. They should have been more ruthless with their editing here. Overall, though, 4 stars, very, very impressed.
Very impressed. What are you saying, Kate?
Yeah, I agree. The album for me, it's a total example of like creating authentic power as well. And it's I'm just excited to see what they do when they actually meet. It's 4 out of 5 from me.
4 out of 5. Well, that's a pretty solid and unanimous star rating there from both of you. Let's move on then to Stephen Fretwell and an album called Busy Guy. Back after something of a hiatus with this third album, although we can argue till the cows come home whether it's a third album or a fourth album, Kate. But first of all, his songwriting credentials, highly rated, Ivor Novello nominated, but yet he's been quiet for quite a while.
Yeah, he was quiet for a very long time. His last album was released in 2007, Man on the Roof. And actually, did you know that his the song Run is recognisable because it's the theme tune for Gavin and Stacey? So a lot of people mightn't have heard of him, but they actually will be like, oh, I know some of
I
his
know
music.
That song.
Yeah, exactly. I actually hadn't. I heard Embankment a few weeks ago and I fell in love with the song and I had to go and look up who he was. And then I discovered that he actually supported Oasis, and I'm a massive Oasis fan. So it's like, how did I miss him? But he was away. When I say away, he just decided to leave the music by the by and become a father. He became a father and he decided to dedicate the last number of years to raising his children. And he's kind of, I think he's really interesting because he seems to be this kind of little, he's got cult status.
Yeah.
He's got these huge fans, you know, including Arctic Monkeys, who covered one of his tracks a while back, which is actually what got him back into writing music now.
Well, let's listen to the song that awoke your interest, Embankment.
Are we dancing now? Sweet Judith, my hands are bleeding. Sweet Judith, my heart it's beating now. Listen, there it goes again.
Embankment, the title of that track from Busy Guy, new album from Stephen Fretwell. I was saying as we were listening to that, Brian, it really is just him and his guitar. Now, that track has a little bit of extra production in or instrumentation added in there as well, but that's quite unusual across the 10 or so tracks from the album. He's asking a lot, just him and his guitar, isn't he?
It's on first listen, Sean, it is a tough ask because you're in like deep, deep singer-songwriter mode here. But he really suffered under, he had moderate success way back in 2004, like top 30. As Kate was saying, he's very much a musician's musician. Bands will sing his praises. Mm. However, he doesn't really do the business. And he really suffered under the label, the British Jeff Buckley. And you can hear why, because he has that, those sweet acoustic ballads and those very, very poetic lyrics also. But I would ask people to stay with this album because it really does reveal itself in repeated lessons. I thought I was amazed by it. And I love the fact that I think his marriage just broke up and he now lives in London. And this is very much a London album. Even we were talking about the name of the songs are named after tube stops, Oval and Embankment. And you do get, perfect for our weather today, you get this hazy urban imagery of London and some. And he mentions places, he mentions people. It's very much an urban album, but done with that sort of pastoral feel.
Yeah.
But I do agree. It's a tough ask, but give it time. These songs are wonderful. Yeah.
And I think for you, Kate, too, the second half of the album, which is, am I right in thinking the last four or five songs, they're all colours, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah, they are. Like he actually, so his marriage, he's in recently speaking in an interview, he was saying that, you know, to go back to music, he knew that that was going to mean the end of his marriage. And so there's a lot of sadness and loss there. Mm. Do you know, it's like, you know, having one thing or not and having the other thing and not, do you know what I mean? Having to choose. And Oval, actually, it's interesting you bring up Oval, that track, because he says that that track was the first and the only one that he had written before his marriage was breaking up. And it was actually about his wife when she was pregnant originally, and they used to live around Oval, and he was just thinking and reminiscing on it. So I think it's quite cathartic, and I totally agree with Brian, like it absolutely is revealing itself. It's the first listen, like my partner was listening to it this morning and she was like, oh, it's, you know, it's very same, and I was like, yeah, but there's so much depth to it. And there's Dan Carey has produced it, and Dan Carey, for anyone who doesn't know, I think is one of the most prolific producers currently. If I hear something and I like it, and it will be no surprise to me that Dan Carey will have produced it.
So
recorded this in 2 hours, that's it, just 2 hours.
If it is samey, then that's not because of the songs, it's because you have to listen carefully to hear the differences. Let's have a listen to it, is what you're both saying, I think, there. Let's have a listen to a track called The Long Water.
Hey man, where's the money gone? I was in the drink, I was swimming up, startled by the song, the seabird's song. And all the years line up giddy and wait, they descend the stairs of the cabaret ballet. As they skip off, make plans on which to renege. It's been a long
time. Okay, we're sitting here in studio, Kate Brennan Harding, going, that sounds really like something.
It's Wild World by Cat Stevens.
That's exactly what it is, yeah.
Singing it over and over and over again because of that. I was there, what is it? And I started humming it to myself and I was like, oh God, that's it, you know. Yeah. Which doesn't take away from that song at all.
No, Brian, what
is it? That's funny, Kate, because I was thinking of, in that song, in Long Water particularly, do you remember Peter Sarsgaard's big hit, Where Do You Go To My Lovely?
Yes,
there's a sort of a there's a bossa nova rhythm in there that reminded me of that. That happened to me a few times in this album. But then, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt there.
No, go ahead.
But we were saying about the sparseness and it was just guitar voice. But then you get to a song called Pink, which he sings unaccompanied. Just at the very end, there's just tiny bits of studio noise. I don't think there's even any guitar on it. And then there's a song called Green, which is jazz guitars.
Yeah.
So you almost need like whatever the equivalent of a microscope for the ear is. You really must listen to this and you really must focus on it. It only really... And it needs repeated listens, but I was astonished by how good this was. And I did get a real David Gray feel off it.
Now that's it. The comparisons to David Gray jump out right enough. And the other thing I was saying to Brian here in studio, Kate, was that, you know, they on my Spotify, the kind of random listen thing, is the default setting, which drives me nuts. I love to hear one track after another. And I think this album probably needs that because I'd say he has graded his tracks very carefully in terms of the journey he wants you to go on with them.
Yeah, I think it's completely crafted and I think you do need to listen to the album from beginning to end and not jump around, especially in terms of when you start looking at the names and the lyrics of the songs. And then especially as Dan Carey has sort of employed these little tricks, exactly like the jazz or the small little piano electronic moments that I actually had to take off my headphones and go, am I listening to something else? Do you know? Because it's kind of different, but it's multi-layered but very delicate.
Yeah, I do not understand why random listen is the default setting. why isn't one track after another the default setting? But that's another argument for another day. Stars from you, Kate?
It's a 4 out of 5 and I absolutely think anyone should go and buy this simply because I don't know if Stephen thinks that he should have returned to making music and I think he needs many people to say yes, thank you for returning
for
to making
it.
Music.
Okay, well, and I think you're probably in a very similar camp on that one, Brian.
4.5, highly, highly recommended.
Four
to
and a half, highly, highly recommended. I'm going back to get the random listen setting off my Spotify immediately. Okay, let us. That's a Busy Guy is the title of the album there from Stephen Fretwell. Let's move on to the Goon Sax. Here's a track called Tag. The title of that track from the album Mirror 2 from the band The Goon Sax. The Goon Sax, first of all, set up who this Aussie indie rock are and the lineage that they have, Kate.
So they're a trio from Brisbane, Australia, and one of them is Louis Foster, and his father is Robert Foster, who some people, a lot of Irish people will know as being the co-founder of the Go-Betweens. So this is their third album, but their first on Matador. And if you go to their back catalogue, they're a lot more kind of jangly bedroom DIY pop with a lot of kind of cowbells and things like that. Whereas this album is a lot darker. And I think it reflects the fact that they've all been living in Berlin and it was recorded in London. So very different from like their first album, they were still in school. And it just sort of launched them quite quickly. They became, people just became really interested in their quirky lyrics and their self-deprecating kind of style. But yes, this album is quite different, I think, from the previous two.
All right. And as you mentioned, Louis Forster, one of the band members, the other two being James Harrison and Riley Jones. Are they giving us anything to get excited about here, Brian?
Unfortunately not, and I really wanted, I really, really wanted to love this album because, as Kate was saying with the Go-Betweens connection, Go-Betweens is one of my favourite bands of all time. They have a female drummer. The Go-Betweens had a female drummer. They're post-punk. Yeah. They're from Brisbane, so they're asking for comparisons. I just found it, it's such a limited palette. It's almost like they've made this album, so it would be liked by Pitchfork. Now, the conceit here is that there's three of them. Three of them wrote the songs and three of them take turns on vocals. What we just heard there, the song Tag, the drummer Riley Jones, she is the best vocalist on this album. Poor Louis Foster, he can't. Oh, it's deadpan, it's colourless, it's monotone. I just could not get my head around it at all. I really wanted to and I struggled with it. But and also, have this band ever listened to anything outside the Velvet Underground and Jonathan Richman and the Modern Lovers? I mean, I was noticing so many references here. And then I heard the Kevin Shields Wall of Noise guitar sound. Then I heard Tom Verlaine angular guitar chords from television.
Oh, right.
And I'm thinking, okay, this is why music journalists like them, because they're ticking all the boxes. But for God's sake, guys.
Yeah, yeah. I can hear you bursting to agree, I think, Kate. Am I right?
Oh, 100% agree, yes. I wanted to like this album. I liked their previous album. Well, I liked some songs in the previous album. But I think what's been really kind of more and more obvious to me is that I like Riley Jones, exactly what Brian's saying. Mm. And I like her singing style, and I like the kind of, you know, I suppose there is definitely Nico vibes, Velvet Underground vibes on a lot of the stuff that she's doing. But the others are just, like, he just cannot sing. Mm. And, you know, I know singing is different people will hear different things, but for me, there was two tracks and I wanted to throw my speakers out the window.
Carpentry,
you know, they were irritating me so much, you know.
What irritated you?
The two tracks, well, the first track is the song called Temples, and it absolutely left me. It's got this sound that's going through it, and I have misophonia, and it all you hear is this kind of, it's like a white noise.
Yeah, I said out of tune drone was what I've written down beside Temples. What was the other one?
Was it Carpentry, Kate?
It was Carpentry.
Yes. I was going to throw my laptop out the window with that song.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, well, you two had it with that. I had it with this song, Bathwater, quick flash of it.
Overdue by days, watching like a TV film, but living in no other place.
I just thought, why are you singing out of tune? And then I thought, I'm an old man.
I'm glad to hear that you're
both agreeing with me.
There's supposed to be a sort of a post-ironic, wry approach.
Right.
No, guys, go back to school.
Right, well, stars. Was there going to be any post-irony in this one from you, Brian?
One and a half. It's awful.
And what are you saying, Kate?
Well, what I'm saying is I think the band should break up, and I think Riley Jones should go and write her own music herself. A score is 2 out of 5. I wasn't as harsh, but 2 out of 5 because
you weren't as harsh. You weren't exactly throwing them out at them either.
No.
I think I kind of get where both of you were on Mirror 2 from the Goonsacks there before that. Busy Guy from Stephen Fretwell, going back to listen to it in the correct order later this evening, and New Vessels from Ragara, the three albums that we had. Brian Boyd and Kate Brennan-Harding are reviewers on this Friday evening, and that is our lot for this Friday, indeed for this week here on Arena. Liam Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Jimmy Doyle was on sound this evening, and tonight's programme was produced by Olin McGowan. I will talk to you Monday, 7 o'clock once again here on RTÉ Radio 1. Can I say that we have a big actor on Monday? Yes, I can. Andrea Riseborough we will be speaking to on Monday evening on the programme. I'm looking forward to that enormously. Ahead of the film that she's in, which is opening, the Galway Film Flag.